Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'm going to be speaking today with Mark Herzegard. He's the executive director of Covering Climate Now, the environmental correspondent for The Nation, and author of several books, including Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth. And you can learn more at coveringclimatenow.org. That's coveringclimatenow, all one word, .org. On Free Forum, we explore the lives, the work, the ideas of individuals I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at politics, economics, environment, science, health, culture, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. The show airs on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and on kpfk.org Thursdays at 3 p.m. Pacific. Streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on tunein.com. And podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, most major podcast sites, and at my site, terrencemcnally.net. TerrenceMcNally.net. Mark Herzegard and I met on a story he did in January 1999 issue of Mother Jones on the development battle over LA's Biona Wetlands. And this story was part of his 1998 book, Earth Odyssey, based on his round-the-world reporting from 1991 to 1997. And I've turned to Mark often for his views on the trajectory of the climate crisis, as well as our response. And we've been in touch consistently over the years, also as friends and allies. 10 years before Earth Odyssey, Mark had written On Bended Knee, which called out the national press for their handling of Ronald Reagan. And I remember being surprised when I learned that this well-regarded book that took on the press was written by someone so young, 32 at the time. Well, we've sort of come full circle. More than three decades later, Mark, now a veteran journalist and author, has co-founded Covering Climate Now, again, to up the press's game, this time when it comes to reporting on climate. We'll talk about the new organization, but I'm still going to get his current take on the climate crisis. What's new? What's surprising? What don't we know enough about? We'll talk about our responses to it, the effects of the war in Ukraine and of inflation. We'll assess the potential impact of the Inflation Reduction Act and look at some of the actions in the states, California in particular. And we'll talk about the press. Why does he feel the need to move in this direction at this time, to shift from full-time reporting to this work to get other reporters and the wider press to step up? How is the press coverage of the climate crisis broken? What's the evidence? How did it happen? What's the history, the culprits? And how do we fix it? What does he hope to see? What does he see as success? Mark Herzegard, the nation's environment correspondent, has covered climate change since 1989. His books include On Bended Knee, as I mentioned, and Earth Odyssey, and Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth. He's executive director, as I said, of Covering Climate Now, which he co-founded with Kyle Pope, the editor and publisher of the Columbia Journalism Review. And on their site, the mission is to help, quote, news media cover the defining story of our time with the rigor and urgency it deserves. Welcome again, Mark Herzegard, to Free Forum, a world that just might work.
It's always so good to be with you, Terrence. Thanks for having me.
Oh, you're very welcome. And let me tell people, we're recording this conversation Thursday, September 8th. As you know, I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas we talk about. So can you talk a bit about your path and what's led you to this shift in kind of your personal mission and your personal focus?
You know, sometimes I joke that now that I'm the executive director of Covering Climate Now, I'm not a journalist so much anymore as I am a bureaucrat, because I'm running a global media collaboration that has some 500 news outlet partners that reach a total audience of some 2 billion people. And that takes a lot of managing. We have some of the biggest names in news involved with Covering Climate Now. Everyone from The Guardian, our lead media partner, and our co-founders, as you mentioned, Columbia Journalism Review and The Nation magazine, but also the global news agencies, Bloomberg and Reuters and Agence France-Presse and the networks, ABC News, CBS News, NBC News, PBS, etc. So, You asked why I've taken this course, and I'll tell you, it grew out of my reporting on climate. As you mentioned, I've covered climate since 1989, and I've spent a lot of my career overseas.
Mm-hmm.
And every time in the 90s and the aughts, when I came back to the United States from overseas travel, it was always very striking and frankly distressing to see that the climate conversation in the United States, in the media and in politics, which are usually the same thing in this country, it was 10 years behind where the conversation was in Europe, which is to say that long after Germany and Britain and France and the media in those countries were ignoring climate deniers, in the United States, you still saw climate deniers getting equal billing with real scientists. And this continued for years and years. So in the foundational story for Covering Climate Now dates back to almost 4 years ago, the landmark report by the UN scientific body, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And they did a report in October of 2018 called the 1.5 degrees report, where they looked at what will happen if the Earth's average temperatures increased by 1.5 degrees Celsius, which is about almost 3 degrees Fahrenheit. And the science, so I was covering that as a beat reporter for The Nation magazine. And I was listening to these scientists, and they were saying, you know, in the next 12 years, by the year 2030, we must fundamentally transform the world economy, all of its sectors, so the energy sector, the transport sector, the construction sector, the agriculture sector, the finance sector, on and on and on. And they never mentioned the media sector. And when they didn't mention the media sector, I thought to myself, if we don't transform the media sector, none of those other sectors are going to transform in time, because there won't be the public awareness and therefore the public pressure on governments and businesses to do what is needed fast enough. And that's where the idea of Covering Climate Now began, was to try and talk to my fellow reporters and editors and producers throughout the media and get them to face up to the biggest story of our time. And I knew from my own dealings with a lot of my colleagues that there were many, many journalists, including in the mainstream biggest news organizations, who knew perfectly well that this was a huge story and that we in the media, by and large, were blowing it. And I thought that if we could get those journalists together and somehow make common cause, that we might be able to change that. And so that's what we did. We started at Columbia Journalism School, which of course is the premier journalism institution in the United States. They give out the Pulitzer Prizes every year. And my partner, Kyle Pope, who's the editor and publisher of Columbia Journalism Review, and I, and Katrina Vandenhoevel, the publisher of The Nation, we got together with Bill Moyers, the legendary TV newsman, and we pulled together this conference to just get journalists talking about it. And from there, it has grown and grown, and frankly, it took off like a rocket and has grown to a scale and scope and ambition that none of us really anticipated, but we are very grateful, because of course the climate emergency only gets more dire and more punishing by the day, and it is essential for the media to step up.
Okay, well, I think what I want to do now, and thank you for that, and that moment, I can just imagine actually, as at that conference, something in the back of your mind goes, wait a minute. it's a very clear pivot point, and I can really imagine the sense that came over you at that moment. I'm going to shift now to an update on the climate crisis and our responses, the Inflation Reduction Act, etc., and then we'll shift back to more about how Covering Climate Now is functioning, what you're seeing, what your hopes are, those sorts of things. But first, let's deal with the news as it is. What to you are the headlines these days, the most significant threats and responses?
Sure. I think what we're seeing now is the climate emergency is unfolding in real time. And average people can see that. You don't have to be a scientist anymore to understand that the planet is overheating and that the weather is going haywire. All you have to do is look out the window.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you and I both live here in California.
Yep.
The fire season in this state there was always a fire season every year, but it began right about now.
Yep.
You know, September, October, November, before the winter rains come. Now, fire season in California is effectively year-round. And that's not an exception around the world. Every place that you travel, and as I mentioned, I've spent a lot of my career overseas. I've reported on climate change from 25 countries around the world. And the climate emergency is coming much faster and harsher than scientists had been predicting 15, 10 years ago. You know, we're seeing things happen now with sea level rise, with drought, with heat, with floods that scientists projected, but they thought they would come at the end of this century instead of 22 years into it. So that's the main thing, that the climate emergency is just unfolding so much faster than people thought. And unfortunately, societies are simply not ready for it. Governments are not taking the action necessary. Corporations are not taking the action necessary. The fossil fuel industry is still lying and blocking forward action. So, you know, we've got a big challenge on our hands.
So just so people hear what you said and not kind of glaze over it, at the time that the debate kind of in America and the press and the back and forth and so on was whether it's real, how real is it, human caused, all that crap, what was actually happening was that the people that were being called alarmists or that sort of thing, who were saying there's a crisis, they hadn't anticipated how quickly and how ferociously it would happen.
Not just they. I think many of them just, you know, the deniers, they didn't want to believe it. Now, that's separate from the oil companies. We now know from internal documents that the oil companies knew perfectly well from their own scientists back in the 1970s and 1980s that if they kept burning, you know, oil, gas, and coal as their business plans projected, that we would have exactly what we're seeing now. But the point I was making is that even the...
No, that's what I was saying, by the way, Mark, was that the folks that they were pointing to and saying, oh, they're alarmists. The alarmists were alarmed, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
That the story wasn't, is there a problem? The story was, if you went to an actual scientist, the problem is happening faster and worse than we thought.
Yeah, that's the thing. You know, and so you now have, and this is an important development, about in the last 2 years, scientists are now getting much more outspoken than they were 5, 10, 15 years ago. You can look, there's a, in the peer-reviewed journal Biosciences, there is now an open letter where there's, I think last time I looked, there were 14,000 scientists who signed this open letter that essentially declares, we need to think of climate change as an emergency. We face a climate emergency. That's the phrase. And the reason that phrase is important, it's helpful to think of it with a parallel to your health. You know, it's an emergency when you have a heart attack. You need treatment within minutes or you're going to die, as opposed to a crisis. If you get a cancer diagnosis, that's a crisis, right? But you need to get treatment. But if you get treatment and go see your doctor in an hour or 2 hours or even the next day, your outcome's not going to be very different. We're now at a point with climate change that it's an emergency. We have to act now. We have to act rapidly. We have to do a lot in a very short time.
Yeah, that's a good analogy. This is more like sepsis.
I guess that's one way to look at it.
Well, yeah. Right? I mean, sepsis is when the systems break down and you then have a cascade of negative consequences that all of a sudden are triggered. I mean, that's sort of what I see here.
Yeah.
So that's a positive shift. And so I guess what we're saying is the facts on the ground, the fires, the floods in Pakistan and so on, people don't really have to be told about that in this interview because that's pretty obvious. What might be in those current crises, what might be worth hearing your take on is who's getting hurt by what's happening now versus who caused what's happening now.
Well, you're putting your finger on what we at Covering Climate Now say is one of the fundamental facts about the climate emergency, which is the injustice of it. And you're seeing this now coming out of Pakistan. The Minister of Climate and Energy in Pakistan just the other day said that Pakistan deserves reparations because this problem of climate change is caused by the rich world's emissions, And Pakistan is on the harsh end of the suffering, even though Pakistan is responsible for less than 1% of the global heat-trapping emissions. Compare that to China, compare that to the US, compare that to Britain and the other European, the industrialized countries who, over the last 250 years, have burned fossil fuels and become rich by doing it. So that's the great injustice. And it's not to say that people in rich countries aren't getting hurt. We know, again, here in California, these fires that we've had in recent years and the heat and so forth, they're hurting all kinds of people, not just the poor and the people of color and the other disadvantaged groups, but also wealthy people. But globally, there's no question that the people who are suffering first and worst are the ones who did the least to cause this emergency. And that is simply immoral.
And then I would say one other thing that's worth mentioning, although people might realize it, is that cities in America and elsewhere around the world, but let's focus on America here, that are some of our fastest growing, some of, if you'd go back 10 years, they were the future of America. They were the Sun Belt where things were happening. There's the possibility that Phoenix, which is now, what, the third or fourth largest city in the country, may be uninhabitable in a few years.
You know, I just saw a story the other day pointing out that not just Phoenix, but so much of the southern part of the United States, especially the southwestern part of the United States, people are still moving there.
Oh, my
large
God.
Numbers. And you just want to shake your head and shake them by the shoulders and say, will you please rethink this? Because you're moving into a desert and there is not going to be enough water. And this is also the case here in California. You know, people forget. Certainly non-Californians, but I think even people on the coast, forget that California is basically a desert state, and we do not have as much water, and especially will not have as much water going forward as we have in the past, and we are going to have to adapt to that. That was what my book Hot was about, is that how do we deal with the climate impacts that can no longer be stopped? And Phoenix is a kind of a poster child for doing exactly the opposite, sleepwalking towards disaster.
And I have to throw Vegas in there as well. Those two cities that are kind of the ones that we look to the east and see those first two big cities, both thriving, both still getting people migrating to them, could be unlivable in a few years. And we recently saw that the talks, speaking about California, Arizona, and the rest of the Southwest, that the talks to figure out how to deal with the water shortage in the Colorado River, which is the source of water or the source of a great deal of water for a number of states, those talks broke down and there had to be kind of an decision from above for immediate action. What's going on in that realm?
Yes, Colorado River is a major water source, as you said, for a lot of states, including California, although we're very distant from it. And let's remember our neighbors to the south, Mexico as well.
Exactly.
And nobody from my following, I haven't reported this story, but I've read the reporting about it. And the states and the tribes who are involved with sharing this are not really yet grappling with the hard choices. And everyone still thinks that they can plan on having as much water as there used to be in the 20th century coming through the Colorado River. That is not what the science tells us. The science tells us that there is going to be increasingly less and less water in the Colorado. And until that fact is faced, there's going to be a lot of social stress and unrest and governments arguing. The latest indication is that if these states cannot come up with a solution, the federal government will impose a solution. And with the Biden administration in charge, at least for the next 2 years at least, the climate scientists there know perfectly well what I just said, that there's not going to be enough water. And so it's going to be very interesting to watch that and see, does the federal government come in and, like separating a bunch of unruly children, say,
yeah,
okay, if you can't sort this out yourselves, here's what we're going to do. And everybody is going to take a big haircut.
Yeah, but the negative side effect of that, which I'm sure is well considered already in the federal offices that might have to deal with this, is the kind of anti-federal government politics that will happen in a state like Arizona. if the federal government has to come in and impose rules. We see it in California when you drive up Route 5, and you see that the Central Valley has, you know, anti-Pelosi signs in on the agricultural land next to the freeway because the federal government has made some rules about how much ag can have in California's water supply.
Yes, and let's remember the agriculture sector uses 80% of California's available water. 80%. When we hear that, and Governor Newsom recently has imposed restrictions on urban dwellers,
of
course that makes sense, but you can't solve the problem if you leave 80% of the situation out of consideration. And so that's another big thing to watch is, I would say, when will the state of California finally take on the big agricultural interests in the Central Valley, many of whom are wasting water, in particular by growing crops that there is no business growing thirsty crops in a desert, thirsty crops like cotton, like alfalfa, like almonds. You should not be growing them in a desert state like California is.
Yeah, I mean, what made sense 20 years ago and made dollars 20 years ago is now foolish and perhaps immoral. When you see how much, and there again, politics rears its head because one would assume that Gavin Newsom has his eye on the 2024 presidential campaign when he's making decisions today about California's environment.
Well, I have no idea. Newsom repeatedly denies that, but the larger point is that politics and legalities and all these things, this is a big part of adapting to climate change. So when I wrote my, one of the big challenges really of adapting, when I wrote my book Hot, a whole chapter there is devoted to the Netherlands, which along with Bangladesh are two countries that are very far advanced in adapting to climate change, to listening to what science tells them is coming in the decades to ahead, and then trying to prepare. And when I talked to the chief climate scientist for the Netherlands, I said, what advice would you give to the rest of the world about how to emulate your success? And he said, start early.
Oh.
Start early, because what takes time, he said, is not the engineering of, you know, putting up, in their case, you know, sea level protections, dams and dikes and so forth. That's not what takes the time. What takes the time is working through all the politics and the legal challenges, and especially you in the United States, you said, where private property is a god, is a sacred god. It's not going to be easy for you to do the things that are going to be, that science is going to require. And that's exactly what you're talking about with the kind of, in the United States, there is this anti-government sentiment in much of the West. There's also a very individualistic attitude here. Private property is king, the individual, the libertarian impulse that goes back to the founding of the country. These are not things that are going to be helpful as we as a society face the challenges that climate change is going to throw at us in the decades ahead.
As you were referring to that conversation with the fellow in the Netherlands, I heard in my the back of my mind a conversation I had with Danella Meadows before her death. We're talking probably 25 years ago, and that's what she said was the great challenge for the United States, was that we will often do the right thing, but even after the decision is made, that lag time, when you deal with the lobbyists and you deal with the politics and you deal with the C-suites, is something, you know, that we know. We've seen it and we see it over and over again. But in this kind of an emergency, as you pointed out, not just a crisis, an emergency, that kind of lag time it makes everything more difficult and more expensive.
True. And that's why it's so important to remember that the good things that have happened recently, especially with the upsurge of climate activism among young people around the world. You know, when Covering Climate Now started 3 years ago, we started literally this month, September 2019, with a joint week of coverage where we got, at that point, we had 323 partner news outlets. And we all said, okay, we're all going to do a week of coverage right before the United Nations Climate Week. And so we did it. And on the fifth day, it was a Friday, and a young woman named Greta Thunberg and her comrades put 6 million protesters in the streets of world capitals around the world. And that was a real wake-up call for my colleagues in the media, many of whom said to me, wow, how did you know they were going to do that? Well, we didn't know they were going to do that. But when newsrooms saw that, when politicians saw that, they recognized, oh my gosh, we have got to start paying attention to climate change after all. And so they have not yet done what's necessary, but they've come a lot farther than they were. You know, we've now got basically the goal, the recognized goal internationally, is no longer to limit temperature rise to 2 degrees Celsius, because we see, look out the window again.
Yes.
So far, we've raised it by 1.2 degrees Celsius. Have a look. It's not looking great. So now the target is 1.5 degrees, and that is, you know, very few people deny that any longer outside of, you know, Shell, Oil, and Exxon.
Well, it's interesting. If you look at it, at 1.2, we already have the fires and the floods and the displacement and the extreme weather events. And at 1.2, the drought's not going to stop. These things are not going to get better. They're probably going to get worse even if we stay where we are, just because of the feedback loops built in. So getting reduction is to 1.5, which is more than we have now, is you know, that is the goal. Again, if you look outside, you'll go, that doesn't even seem like, you know, like, what am I saying? Like a distant goal. That seems like the bare minimum. Let me ask you about a couple of things, and that I wondered if they are affecting the climate crisis and our ways of dealing with it. One is the war in Ukraine, and the other is inflation internationally. Any comments about either of those?
Sure. I think Ukraine shows, and we've been encouraging this kind of reporting through Covering Climate Now, Ukraine shows the real dangers that come with a fossil fuel-based economy, that you as a country, you as an economy, and this is especially true for Europe, you are at the beck and call of petro-dictators around the world, Vladimir Putin in this case, who can basically shut off your economy by shutting off the oil. So that is an illustration, I think, of the difficulty and a goad towards saying, okay, then we really have to accelerate our push away from fossil fuels. Of course, you know, the usual suspects on the other side are invoking the Ukraine crisis as further reason why, well, we've got to drill more, we've got to do more fossil fuels. So that's a big fight that is underway now. And I think that the recent passage of the big climate bill in Washington, the so-called Inflation Reduction Act, was an important victory in that sense. That bill has a lot of flaws to it. It doesn't do what science says. It throws environmental justice under the bus. But it is also a historic achievement. And that it happened, that you got a major investment in clean energy, that happened in the wake of the Ukraine war, I think is a sign that the winds of change are shifting on this, both politically and economically. You know, in world finance, the big investment money that they got out of fossil fuels a long time ago, mm-hmm. because they saw where the future is going. All of the world's auto manufacturers now, they are all planning for an all-electric vehicle future. So it's a battle. It's a battle between the emerging industries of a green economy for the rest of the century and the incumbent industries, the fossil fuel industries, who still are trying to hang on to the riches that and power that they accumulated over the last 100 years. And it's going to be a battle to see who is going to come out on top. But I will say this, that, you know, things, although the science and the actual impacts around the world with the storms and the floods and the hurricanes and the heat and so forth, that's getting worse. At the same time, on the politics side, things are getting better. And it's going to be a question to see, you know, which wins the race.
Yeah, yeah. The thing that I've always felt about old industries is and by old, you know, at this point, that's how I refer to the fossil fuel industry, the entrenched power and the entrenched wealth that it has accumulated by being the dominant energy sector allows it, gives it the bullying power to, if it can't stop, to at least delay and disable the efforts to move to the next technology, to move to the next energy source. And it's you know, you can just look at it as almost like a physical law. That's what happens when you have tons of entrenched power and wealth. You again, it's a lag in doing the right thing. Let me tell people, this is Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'm Terrence McNally, speaking with Mark Hertzgard. He's executive director of Covering Climate Now, a global journalism initiative committed to more and better coverage of the climate story. He's also the environment correspondent for The Nation magazine and author of several books, including Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth. You can learn more about the news organization at coveringclimatenow.org. All one word, coveringclimatenow.org. And you can look for Mark's work at The Nation and The Guardian, where he appears regularly at both of them. So let's talk about the Inflation Reduction Act in a little more detail. How do you see its potential impact? What are its best features? What are its weaknesses?
Yeah, its best features is that it is making a huge, huge investment in clean energy. And the essential bet here, if you will, the strategy behind it is that by subsidizing clean energy, that is solar, wind, energy efficiency, conservation, battery storage, etc., by the government subsidizing that, it's going to continue to drive down those costs. And bear in mind, already today, solar-powered electricity, wind-powered electricity is economically cheaper than fossil fuel electricity, coal, oil, and gas. But this is going to drive it even further down. And so the bet of the bill is that they're going to drive clean energy prices so low that oil, gas, and coal will simply no longer be able to compete in the marketplace, and consumers and businesses will leave the fossil fuels behind in favor of clean energy. There's a lot of reason to think that that will indeed happen. We saw in 2009, when the government was trying to pull the U.S. economy out of the global recession caused by the housing bubble popping, that the government invested $90 billion in clean energy. Now, today's $370 billion is adjusted for inflation is about three times as much. That earlier $90 billion, that's exactly why today solar and wind are cheaper than fossil fuels. So if you now triple that investment, it's very, very likely that those costs are going to go down. So I think that that's that could be the kill shot for fossil fuel, the fossil fuel industry's economic future. So that's the positive side of, and I'd say the second positive side I alluded to earlier, which is that, you know, the fact that such a bill passed at all is an indication, again, that the zeitgeist is changing, partly because of the young people protesting, partly because you can now just look out the window and see, you know, there's orange skies over San Francisco, people are dying in Pakistan, etc. And thank goodness, my colleagues in the press are now speaking up. You know, we founded Covering Climate Now to break the climate silence that prevailed within the media, and we did, along with help from, obviously, you know, Greta Thunberg and the others who were protesting. But the media is still too climate quiet. And so that's where the push now has to be. But they are getting better and better. You now see at the Washington Post, for example, the dominant newspaper in the nation's capital, they have three or four climate stories every day on their front of their homepage. That is changing, again, how politicians think about all this. So that's the positive side of the Inflation Reduction Act. There's also negative sides. You know, they had to get Joe Manchin's vote in order to get this through, and Manchin exacted a price for his vote. That's how, again, that's how politics works. And one of the prices is that, yes, $370 billion, that's a lot, but the bill is all carrot and no stick. There's incentives, there's subsidies, but there's no penalties for continuing, for electric utilities continuing to burn gas or coal. And that was dropped from the earlier version. You remember the Build Back Better legislation of the previous year. There were going to be sticks as well as carrots. So those got dropped. And now there's also the sort of the side deal where there'll be a second vote coming up very soon in Congress about what another thing that Manchin demanded and got to, as the price of his vote, was that there will be a vote on so-called permitting reform, which is basically that they're going to loosen the requirements for getting a permit to do pipelines and fossil fuel expansion. And so there's going to be a big, big fight on Capitol Hill against that now as to whether that is going to go through or not. And so people who want to get involved with that, you should check all of the environmental groups, literally all of them, are opposing that measure. And so we'll see. And the problem with that, of course, as I mentioned earlier, is that if you do increase permitting and auctions of offshore leasing of oil drilling and so forth, that is an environmental injustice, because the people who live near those fossil fuel production sites are, of course, as I mentioned earlier, the people who are the poor. They're usually people of color. They are disadvantaged, marginalized in many ways. They have been poisoned by fossil fuel development for decades. And now they are being asked to continue to be poisoned in return for the price of Joe Manchin's support. So we'll see whether that happens. I will just add one last thing. And I wrote about this in my article in The Nation. So people who want to read it can go look. It's called, Does the New Climate Bill Throw Environmental Justice Under the Bus? And I answered that question by saying, yes, it does, as usual. But but Joe Manchin might be in for a surprise, because, yes, this new bill or the side bill does mandate that there will be more permits and more auctions. But it's really important for people to realize, especially activists who are fighting this or who may be skeptical of that bill, auctions and permits do not necessarily translate into more production. Some company has to bid at that auction to develop that fossil fuel. And some company has to try and get that permit to build that pipeline. And this gets back to what I said earlier. If there's no market for that, if clean energy has so undercut the competitiveness of fossil fuels, what capitalist investor is going to say, oh, well, that looks like a good way to make maximum profits. Let me bid on this oil development possibility or this pipeline. So that's the surprise that Manchin might be in for. He thinks that he's going to get fossil fuel production out of this, but that is not necessarily true.
I get it. Yeah. In other words, the government couldn't, he couldn't have gotten an agreement for production, but what he got was an agreement for easier permitting and so on, but that still takes, I mean, we've seen, we even saw that in the Arctic over the last few years, didn't we? Where some fields were opened up and nobody took advantage.
Not just the Arctic, a lot of places, you know, there's, we don't have to detail them, but yeah, that's the basic point. And unfortunately, I think a lot of the activists who have understandably been opposing this, they assume, and even some of my colleagues in the press have written this, that the side bill necessarily means there's going to be more production. It's like, let me just repeat, auctions and permits do not necessarily translate into more production. And if there's one thing, in addition to the economic arguments, if there's one thing that the climate movement in the United States does quite successfully, is by stopping projects like that at the grassroots level.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Let me also ask about the amount of the investment that's going into things like carbon capture and storage. Talk about that just a little bit. And my guess is, to a lot of people, this is probably a fairly new subject.
Yeah. So you'll hear that carbon capture and storage is part of this bill, and it got, I think, about $20 billion worth of subsidies. So first thing to point out is that carbon capture and storage is not the same as carbon dioxide removal. Carbon dioxide removal refers to how do we get some of the carbon that's already up in the atmosphere out of the atmosphere and into the ground where it can no longer continue to overheat the planet. You know, the best technology for doing that are these wonderful creatures that we share the planet with called trees and plants. They do that through photosynthesis all the time. But we need to stop cutting down forests, and we are probably going to have to figure out additional ways to draw carbon down. And the reason for that is that right now we're at about 421 parts per million of carbon in the atmosphere, and you can see, you know, what that has done to our weather. We need to get down probably to about 350 parts per million. And that means that it's not enough to stop producing more carbon. We've got to actually pull carbon out of the atmosphere. So that, I think, is a technology that absolutely deserves support. But that is a very different point than so-called carbon capture and storage. Carbon capture and storage refers to an existing power plant that is, obviously, if it's burning coal or gas, it's releasing CO2 into the atmosphere. Carbon capture and storage is a technology that, in theory, would capture that CO2 before it leaves the smokestack and gets into the atmosphere, captures it, and then stores it, and again, to where it cannot overheat the atmosphere. The problem with that is twofold. One is that it hasn't been shown to work technologically yet, at least at any economic cost that, any economy in the world, even, you know, centrally planned economies, could tolerate. But the second problem is that it basically becomes a get-out-of-jail-free card to continue burning coal and oil. And that's the wrong direction, not just because of environmental justice concerns for the communities around those facilities burning the carbon, but because, no, we have to stop burning carbon, not continue burning it, and tell ourselves, oh, we're going to capture it. And by the way, when they capture it, the main usage of captured carbon and storage in that theoretical model is, okay, we're going to use it to produce more oil and gas. We're going to pump it down into existing oil wells and use it to push the last remaining drops of oil out of those wells.
Oh my God, so, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, so that's carbon capture and storage is bad with a capital B, but carbon dioxide removal is necessary with a capital N.
And let me just say quickly a couple of things. Regenerative agriculture is something which we've talked about on this program a lot, and that's relying on not just trees, but the way that we grow the food that we eat and the food that and crops in a way that pulls more carbon down. And I suggest people look into that if they're curious about that. I did want to say that it looks like the bill assumes that carbon capture and storage will capture upward of 90% of the CO2. And so the estimates of all the good it will do include that. And as you just pointed out, that is not to be taken for granted and certainly not as preferable as just not burning the stuff in the first place. And before we leave the discussion of that bill, let me just from your article that I read, I just want to throw out a few numbers so that people get the scope of this. The act should create 9 million jobs over the next decade in clean energy, clean manufacturing, and natural infrastructure, according to the Blue-Green Alliance. 9 million jobs is something really not to be sneezed at as we look at what's going on in the larger economy. The bill's backers further assert that it reduced annual U.S. emissions by 40% from 2005 levels by 2030. And three independent analyses have done that. And if achieved, that reduction would approach the 50 to 52% reduction that scientists say is needed to limit global temperature rise to 1.5 degrees. And another point that you make is that by finally passing something, and something, while not ideal or big enough, is of sizable scope, it gives the U.S. much-needed credibility in terms of urging other countries to slash their own emissions and follow suit.
Absolutely. Yeah, the U.S., and you never hear this in the U.S. press, but the U.S. over the last 30 years has been the biggest obstacle to global cooperation and progress on climate change. We, under Democrats and Republicans alike, and this will change that. We will now finally be able to say we are actually reducing our emissions. We have begun to pass real legislation. And once you pass one piece of legislation, it gets much easier to pass another, especially because, as you mentioned, Terrence, you know, 9 million jobs, that's not nothing. And that is going to create is going to expand the existing constituency across the country who will see, wow, this clean energy economy, it's actually an economic benefit. It's not
That's
cost
right.
Us.
The old jobs versus environment argument is absolutely that's Alice in Wonderland talk. It is absolutely the opposite. And if you think about it, even for a second, it's whenever you shift technology or energy sources or any of those sorts of things, that creates new jobs. It has to, even to accomplish the same task you've shifted. That's new jobs. One last question before we'll finish by talking more about the press and covering climate now. What are the chances, and what would it mean if Biden were to declare a federal emergency, a climate emergency?
The president does have the power to create a climate emergency, to declare a climate emergency. It would give him certain additional authority to, for example, to stop oil production in federal lands. There's an excellent story for people who want to pursue this. There's an excellent story that was in the Washington Post yesterday or today. Mm-hmm. A new report has come out that says, you know, whether he declares an emergency or not, there are a lot of other executive actions that he can take to hasten the transition to a clean energy economy. But there's one big caveat here, which is that an executive action can be overturned by the next president. And so it's so much more preferable to pass real legislation. Real legislation can only be overturned if you get the Congress to vote against it and the president to sign the next president to sign that new bill. So executive actions certainly help, and declaring a climate emergency can also, I think, be rhetorically important. Any president has an unmatched bully pulpit to communicate to the American people. And so if he were to say, this is an emergency, this is why I'm doing it, I think that would help to awaken many more Americans to what climate change is and the real threat. Because as much as the listeners to this program are probably quite aware of all of this, many, many, many average Americans don't really know what climate change is. They know about it, they're worried about it, but the data that we see from social science research indicates that, you know, a lot of them think that climate change is caused by plastics or that it is related to the ozone hole. That's just so profoundly wrong. And people don't know, for example, that 99% of scientists agree that climate change is man-made. It's here, it's dangerous, it requires emergency interventions in our politics and economics. So a president who declared a climate emergency and really used the bully pulpit to get that message across and to say, look, we're going to fix this. And this is what Biden already says. We're going to fix this by creating jobs. You know, his famous line is, when I think about climate change, I think about jobs.
Yep.
If he went out and said that to the American public in a more sustained way, I think he could build a lot more political support for what he wants to do and what science says needs to happen.
One thing that you said, Mark, about what the public might believe or might feel and why it would help if they had, you know, both more information, better media, the president taking a thing. Interesting study that I read about in the last couple of days is that a majority of Americans want us to take action on climate, but they think that others don't. Did you see this?
Not only do we see it, we actually write about it in this week's Climate Beat newsletter, which is the weekly newsletter from Covering Climate Now. Anybody who wants to read it, you can go to our website and sign up. It's free. And we write about that in fact, most people say they do want action, and they don't talk about it because they're afraid that other people don't agree. And that goes double and triple for the media. When the media doesn't talk about this, people think it's no big deal. And when politicians don't talk about it, people think, oh, well, it must not be a problem. So that's why it's so important that the media talk about it, and that you and everyone you know talk about it with the people you know. Catherine Hayhoe, the brilliant climate scientist, says possibly the most important thing any of us can do about climate change is to talk about it, so that it's not this taboo subject and that we can all finally recognize, okay, here's a problem, and there are abundant common sense solutions to that problem.
But when I hear that people want it and just think others don't, that strikes me as just such an opportunity for a real flip. In other words, a change in that perspective and that understanding would be enormous when you begin to believe, oh, I'm not alone. Because people love to be part of a winning side. People love to belong. And this notion that, oh, we're in this together is just, I think, would give enormous impetus to all the good things that need to happen. So let's talk about Covering Climate now. You already told us the moment when you decided something like this needed to happen. Briefly, if you could, how did it come together? And what's been like the biggest positive surprises?
It came together out of that conference at Columbia where Bill Moyers gave a superb keynote speech where, you know, amazingly, he managed to have people laughing. In a speech about climate change before he turned serious, it was a brilliant speech. You can go on our website and see the speech.
Oh, see the video as well as just read the speech.
See the video. And Bill also has been advising a foundation for many years, and he convinced that foundation to put up $1 million to get Covering Climate Now off the ground.
Well, there you go.
Yeah, and so that conference was oversubscribed. We had 400 people. We had to not turn people away, but we had overflow rooms for that. And at the end of the conference, everybody realized, well, we got to do something. And my partner, Kyle Pope, said, well, let's all do a week of coverage together.
Right.
So the managing editor at the Philadelphia Inquirer happened to be there, and she said, well, our newspaper's in. And so, great. And I will tell you, honestly, that Kyle and I thought afterwards, well, you know, if we get a couple dozen news organizations to come together like this, we're going to, you know, that's going to make an impact. Well, it took off like a rocket. And within 6 weeks, Bloomberg had joined and CBS News had joined. And there'd been a story in the New York Times. And suddenly we were inundated with requests from all kinds of news organizations of all different platforms, print, digital, radio, TV, U.S., non-U.S., mainstream, independent, progressive, you name it. So within 3 months, there weren't a couple dozen. There were 323
wow.
news outlets who said, we want to be part of this. So that was I wouldn't say it was a surprise, because as I said earlier, I knew that there were a lot of journalists who, like me, recognized that our profession was really blowing this story. And we had to do better. And I thought if we could just pull together that critical mass, we could make that happen. And I think we have. As I say, I think we have decisively shattered the climate silence of the media. That will never come back now. We're still too climate quiet, but we are doing so, so much better than we were, and we just have to keep pushing.
Okay. And so often there's things where you jump out of the gate with some energy, some good thing happens, somebody notices, and good stuff happens right away. The sustainability. Are you saying that the sustainability of Covering Climate Now is working?
Well, so far, I mean, we're a nonprofit, right? So we don't charge anything for news organizations to be part of our collaboration. If we did, that would be a total deal breaker, non-starter. We wouldn't
right.
have maybe half a dozen people joining us. And I have to point out here, by the way, that Pacifica KPFK is one of our partner outlets.
Sure.
Happy to say. So it will depend on us continuing to get financial support. And that has been, frankly, the biggest challenge for us. So anybody who wants to help is listening, we sure would welcome it. You know, we do an awful lot. We have a $1.1 million budget. We have 7 employees who are dealing with, as I said, over 500 news outlets around the world. And, you know, so we are a very lean organization who's accomplishing a lot for a very little. But we still do have to convince, you know, foundations and philanthropists in general to fund us.
Okay. And are there areas where you didn't think, areas of the country, newspaper or media companies, that you thought you might not be able to crack that you have?
Well, let me make that a global question, because to me, in some ways, the most gratifying has been to work with the Times of India, which is the major newspaper in India, which is, people probably know, it's the third largest annual emitter of greenhouse gases behind China and the U.S. That India will have a huge, huge impact on the future of global climate politics. And India is also, like California, you know, a huge, huge, has huge, huge vulnerability to climate impacts. And so the Times of India, having them join us, when we were vetting them, I asked everybody, you know, okay, so how much climate coverage do you do, and how often, and how big is your team, and what's your audience? And the reporter wrote back and answered those questions. And for the audience, she says, as for our audience, We reach slightly more than 1 billion people, which I hope will suffice. So to me, it's outlets like that and some of the smaller outlets in places, as you mentioned, like Oklahoma or Alabama, where you wouldn't necessarily expect that there would be that kind of support, and yet there is.
Oh, that's exciting. I will give you one last question, Mark, which is, and I think I've seen you mention it, is that the way that the press covered the pandemic, that they were nimble, it was fast developing, it was a crisis that wasn't on their books one day and suddenly it was, does that give you hope, or does that even give the press themselves hope that they can do a better job in this one?
Absolutely. That's been a message of Covering Climate Now since the beginning of the pandemic, that we have to treat climate change as an emergency, just like we as the media treated COVID as an emergency. And we have to follow the science, as we did with COVID, not be distracted by the politics or intimidated by politicians and others who were trying to say that the science is baloney. So COVID gives a real, I think, working example of how the press can, in fact, rise to the occasion. And I think the press, for the most part, you know, excluding outfits like Fox, which I don't consider a
press,
journalistic
right,
outfit,
right.
Their propaganda. But I think in general, we did a pretty good job with COVID, and that we need to emulate that with climate.
Yeah. I mean, I've thought a lot of about how the two, you know, how the two crises, or and there are other crises we have as well, but how the shared vulnerability that I feel the pandemic reminded all of us, rich, poor, people of color, you know, or not, it didn't, all around the globe, that shared vulnerability, I think, is something that so applies to climate change the same way it does to the pandemic.
It does, with the following amendment, which is that, as with COVID, it is generally the marginalized who suffer first and worst with climate change. And so, yes, everybody can get that virus and everybody can suffer from climate change, but the rich have an advantage.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It is therefore, we have a moral obligation to make sure that nobody is left behind, whether we're dealing with COVID or climate change or any of the other urgent matters facing our civilization.
Excellent. Excellent, Mark. So again, the website for the new organization is all one word, Covering Climate Now, coveringclimatenow.org. And you said there's a weekly newsletter, which you can go to the site and sign up for. So there's stuff on the site that'll be helpful, including, like you say, Bill Moyers' speech from 2019. But you can get a weekly newsletter, which will tell you what you feel the media needs to know, but so does the public, right?
You bet. It's called Climate Beat.
Climate Beat. And you can find Mark's work also at The Nation magazine and at The Guardian. And if for any reason you don't look at those publications, those are two publications that are going to give you, that are going to do press that is helpful to your life. For this conversation and many other interviews and articles to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, terrencemcnally.net, or A World That Just Might Work.com, all one word, A World That Just Might Work. They're the same website. If you want to get my weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and usually 10 articles about that week's issue or just other timely and relevant issues to stories that we cover on an ongoing basis, you can sign up at my site, terrencemcnally.net, or you can email me at TEMcnally@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to Freeform Podcast at most podcast sites, including Apple Podcasts, Google Play, etc. You can find years of podcasts at my site or at those sites. Listen anytime, anywhere. Michael Lewis, Naomi Klein, Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle, George Packer. You can also follow me on Twitter at McNally Terrence. Thanks to Keanu Williams in production, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all, you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely. And finally, thank you, Mark Hertzgard. Keep up your good work.
Thank you, Terrence, for having me, and you do the same.
Okay.